As you're getting settled, I'm sure you're aware that the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just approach the microphone. You can adjust the podium to your level and just begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Richard Swanson, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Otto. The issue, as I see it before the court, is there's some parts of the hearing that certainly were undisputed, and that's mainly the testimony. There's no question that the stop of the vehicle was proper. The first issue was the much debated case issue is what quantum of evidence is necessary to extend the basis of a lawful traffic stop. And certainly the same standard that is used to determine the lawfulness of a stop is to determine the lawfulness of having someone exit their vehicle so as to perform field sobriety tests. Now, I just want to just brought a few points to the court's attention. And I think it's really significant that at the time of the stop, Mr. Otto was 68 years old. And much has been said about the difficulty of Mr. Otto finding his wallet and or license. Certainly, we can't forget he's 68. And what is overshadowed when we look at that is that he didn't have any difficulties, number one, understanding the request, nor did he have any difficulties providing the wallet. The dexterity of someone that's 68 years old, I don't think can just be forgotten from the equation. Not only that, is my recollection of the facts is that there was a moderate odor of alcohol, which is consistent with consuming alcohol.
Right, and he acknowledged that he had consumed alcohol.
Exactly, and so, and see, this is what sometimes, and you see it all the time, if someone, an officer detects an odor of alcohol, certainly the next question is, have you been drinking? Because they want to see if the person is going to tell the truth. And so if they tell the truth, then that's held against them. Well, you admitted you drink. Yes, well, I didn't say I was under the influence. I had some alcohol.
But he also had, your client had slurred speech, bloodshot eyes. Aren't those just sort of classic indicia of alcohol impairment?
I think with the speech, I believe my recollection was is that the speech was slightly slurred. Okay. Slurred speech, someone 68 years old driving at this time in the evening. Again, we're not looking at someone that's 21, 22 years old, or even the age of drinking. I just think at what seems to be, at least from my perspective, which may not be from the bench's perspective, but there seems to be kind of like a, okay, we pull you over, it's a good stop. You said you were drinking some alcohol. I detect a moderate odor of alcohol, and I'll give you credit because you told me the truth you were drinking. I think that basically we have enough here. Let's leave the vehicle. And I think the big issue I have sometimes is the cornerstone of what I recall the Fourth Amendment is about is what's reasonable. This is the concept that, you know, is basically asked to be looked at is what is reasonable. And certainly, and officers, and I respect law enforcement to the nth degree as to what they do, and they protect all of us. I mean, there's no question about that. But we also can't seem to forget that law enforcement is in a situation that they use their training and experience of making literally countless numbers of DWI arrests in the past and say, well, this is just like every other routine DWI. And I don't know in this type of a case, if you've got someone that's 68 years old, you can basically put that into that same type of regime because we have to take that in consideration.
How about the fact that it's 1:20 a.m.? Is that another fact? And you've had some driving conduct.
And certainly, the time of the day, I think case law has established in the past, the time of the day is one factor to take into consideration, as if it's on the weekend, another factor to take into consideration. But I also don't believe the vehicle was observed leaving from an establishment that sells liquor, which is one other factor that they take into consideration. So it seems to me that it's usually called the judicial icon of the totality of the circumstances, and I'm certainly aware of that. But it seems like, well, what we're going to look at is what we think is consistent with what the reasonable inferences that were made by the law enforcement. And if that is basically we believe is reasonable, then we're going to say that the actions were reasonable. But what about the observations that weren't reasonable? Do they just kind of say, well, that's no, we're not perfect here. We're not saying we have to be perfect. But at some point, I mean, the reasonable inferences that the officer makes just aren't reasonable. And I just mentioned that just reference to the first issue, which is the expansion of the traffic stop. And I just want to discuss a little bit about the next two issues. The second issue, which I have been making consistently for some time now, and I understand it's a very novel idea, and that's something that's not new for me, because it's just, and I mentioned that just because I was listening to that artful argument before this case was called. Both attorneys did such an excellent job. And when the issue about Miranda was coming up, and then I certainly am aware of the law that basically says, well, field sobriety test, we don't need Miranda. And I was thinking about that just then. You know, the whole thing about field sobriety test, that's a directive from law enforcement. And at the time that law enforcement gives that directive, they have in possession of the person's driver's license. And so certainly I can argue that the person was seized, because why is the person going to leave if he doesn't have his or her driver's license? So basically they're detained there until a point that the officer determines that they may let them leave, okay? Well, after maybe 30 years I'm discussing this concept of DWIs, I haven't had too many cases where if an officer basically has someone exit the vehicle, that they let them drive home. It just don't happen. It does not happen. I'm not saying never, okay? But you look at this in the sense that are we going to say, well, you're not under arrest, therefore we don't have to tell you you have your right to counsel. I understand that, and case law says that. But where do you come from to say that it's basically is in the concept of due process or reasonableness to advise someone that they don't have to take these field sobriety tests? And there's case law out there that says, well, some people don't take them. Okay, well, that's true. But the majority, I'm trying to say, the majority of cases that I've handled over 30 years, I haven't had too many that refuse field sobriety tests. But then on the same side, when they refuse a field sobriety test, the bench basically says, well, that can be used as an inference that you refused because you were going to fail. Well, what if I just didn't want to do it? Because I didn't think they had any right to ask me that. But that's not the issue. But I'm just saying, because it comes up in these cases that discuss that. So in the long run, why is it so unreasonable to basically advise someone that certainly doesn't have the right to speak with an attorney because they're not under arrest, so Miranda doesn't come into play. They're directed to do this at law enforcement. And, you know, to say that it's verbal signs of impairment that they use to establish probable cause. Okay, but see, what happens is that person gets out of a vehicle and they're asked to use the step to the rear of the vehicle to conduct field sobriety tests. And that time the officer is behind them and they get to observe their demeanor when they're walking, which is a normal gait, and there's nothing difficult about that. But more often than not, the person doesn't put their left hand on the car to maintain their balance, which is a clear sign, arguably, of an impairment. Okay, it just But I don't know, I mean, and maybe the concern is the public safety. Well, what happens if we give an advice to law enforcement they have to give this morning and people don't give field sobriety tests? You know how difficult that's going to be for us to get convictions? Is that what we're concerned about? The difficulty that it might be to get convictions, or what is fair? And if it's difficult, well, again, based on my training and experience, most, if not all, DWIs, there's a clear sign of impairment. I don't think this would open up any floodgates. There's a clear sign of impairment, and the officers are just doing what they're instructed to do. I mean, they're not going to give that information because they're not told they have to. So they're not going to. So this basically keeps on going and going and going and never goes anywhere. The last issue is probable cause, which everything is kind of intertwined to that except for this point on probable cause in this case. Again, you've got someone that's 68 years old that's basically asked to do field sobriety test, and I understand that when he got out of his, I think it was a truck, got out of his truck, and then there was some statements that he had some medical condition which would prevent him from performing what I like to call the walk to freedom test, or the nine step walk and turn, or the look like a flamingo test, or stand on one foot and count upwards, okay? So the officer said, okay, we're not going to do that, and there's nothing, as I recall, that was definitive in the horizontal gaze nystagmus.
Well, I thought the record was that a finding that Mr. Otto was not understanding the instructions, so he didn't complete the test because he wasn't following what the officer told him to do.
And, Your Honor, you know, and I'm certainly not in dispute of that. Again, I think what sometimes seems to be not in that finding was he was 68 years old. Okay, so is it reasonable to assume that someone that's 68 years old might not understand the verbal instructions given by a police officer? I think we can take judicial notice. Not necessarily at my age, but I mean, we can take judicial notice as a person gets older, that their ability to comprehend and their ability to do everyday tasks sometimes gets slower, sometimes is confusing. And I think that should have been taken into account. But my big issue on the field sobriety test, and again, I know there's the standardized field sobriety test, and I think everyone has heard that, and that has been discussed up and down the judicial DWI case law. And that's patterned after, I believe, the National Safety Highway Administration has put out guidelines as officers basically are encouraged to follow.
Right, because they can be both inculpatory and exculpatory.
That's correct.
Right.
And my concern about the non-standardized field sobriety test is simply this. On the nine-step walk and turn, HGN, and one-legged stand, there's commonly referred to as a decision point that the officer looks for. And there's certain clues that they have. And it's just there's a lot of clues on each one of the tests, and I know my time's slowly evaporating here. But on the non-standardized field sobriety test, there's no guidelines. There's no guidelines for an officer to say, okay, well, this is basically on my training and experience. If you see five of the eight clues, that is sufficient to say that you didn't do very well on that test. And I think that the reason why the guidelines are there, so it takes out the subjective aspect of law enforcement when they're evaluating someone's performance on there. Other than that, it's just, no, he didn't do very well, that was okay.
But what about here where you actually have a PBT result that shows alcohol impairment?
Well, I think that the PBT result certainly was above 0.08, and, you know, I'm not disputing that fact either, but I think if, and the same, I believe the same standard that has been used for getting a person out of a vehicle, and asking for a PBT is that reasonable articulable suspicion. Is there some basis in which we can ask for a PBT? And that's where I come into play, that the HGN was non-determinative, and I acknowledge the court's acknowledgement of the not following instructions, which the age factor comes in. And the other ones just simply don't have any guidelines, and so it's subjective. And so if we're going to base the decision on an officer to offer a portable breath test based upon a subjective analysis, I think that's improper. I just think it's improper. And again, is it reasonable? Is it reasonable for an officer to say, well, I think that your performance on non-standardized field sobriety tests without guidelines, without a decision point, what basis do we judge that as being reasonable? And without any further ado, I'm down to five, and it's slowly going down to zero, so I'll sit now.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. We'll now hear from counsel for the commissioner, please. And there is water there, Mr. Swanson, if you'd like to clear your throat.
A little bit, anyway.
Not much water.
Not much water.
Busy calendar today.
And good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, William Young, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the commissioner. At the outset, I want to respond to a question asked by Judge Flory. There was testimony in the record here about Mr. Otto's failure to follow the instructions during the HGN test. The deputy described how he instructs the test, and then on pages 11 and 12 of the transcript says that he just sort of stared straight ahead. He said he could see the finger, but didn't follow the finger at all, and so the deputy discontinued the test. So,
of what significance is the appellant's age to all of this?
I think it just plays into the totality of the circumstances that needs to be known, and I would point to the.
Is there any indication that the officer had that in mind when the officer drew inferences from his observations?
Nothing from the record would suggest that the officer had any prior knowledge of the appellant, and so he would only know of the appellant's age by looking at the driver's license. And
Ms. Young, was there any indication that, because Mr. Swanson points out that, he gave the officer the wallet and didn't take the license out. Was there any indication in the record that Mr. Otto had some physical impairment or incapacity that would prohibit him from, getting the license out of the wallet?
Nothing in the record.
Okay.
The only suggestion in the record at all about any sort of physical issues is when the deputy asked Mr. Otto to exit the vehicle. He said he wouldn't do the balance tests because of a back injury.
Right, that's right. I remember
that. But beyond that, there was nothing to suggest there were any issues with dexterity with his fingers. Again, one of the non-standardized tests that the deputy tried to administer was a finger dexterity test where he sort of taps his different fingers. And Mr. Otto, it sounds like he started and then just sort of said, I'm not doing that, and just sort of gave up. I think the deputy's words were gave up. So there was nothing was said by Mr. Otto, who had already told the deputy, I'm not doing another test because of my back. Nothing was said to say, I'm having problems with my fingers, I'm having problems with my hands, my motor functions. Nothing to suggest that was aware to the deputy. Additionally, I would direct the court to the State v. Hawkins case about possible innocent explanations that aren't known to the officer. The officer needs to base their reasonable suspicion and their probable cause determinations on what's known and apparent based upon their training, experience, observations. Even if there's possible innocent explanations for conduct and for possible observations, if the officer doesn't know, the law doesn't require the officer to sort of have these assumptions and make these extra steps that cut against their general observations of a normal person. It could be there that eventually the officer may find out something that would explain this, but if the officer doesn't know, he can't be forced to know what he can't know or doesn't know. And I think that sort of undermines a lot of the arguments about the age and any sort of physical issue. The officer made these observations of just general, as Judge Bjorkman mentioned, just pretty standard observations when you approach a vehicle and a routine traffic stop becomes a routine DWI investigation of odor, eyes, speech, admissions of drinking, and he progressed normally, and then he didn't administer the field sobriety test that Mr. Otto said he wasn't going to do because of his issues. And so those weren't even used against him. He just skipped them. So I really don't, I guess I struggle to parse out how the officer used anything against Mr. Otto. But nothing, Mr. Otto wasn't harmed because these weren't even administered in the first place. And if there was no harm, that ultimately sort of undermines the procedural due process claim as well. There's nothing in the record at all suggests that Mr. Otto would have ended up in any different situation than he was in if he'd been given some sort of advisory that the law, as I read it, does not require the officer to provide. Sorry, it looked like you were formulating a question, Judge Flory.
I did not have anything right now.
If there's no other questions,
Just ask you this. I mean, Mr. Swanson is advocating for development of a sort of a new requirement that officers advise someone before undergoing field sobriety tests that they have the option to say no. I mean, it strikes me that a field sobriety test is somewhere along a continuum between an officer's observations of driving conduct and observation of someone sitting in a car and the development of evidence such as the actual breath test or a warranted search of blood or urine. I mean, why doesn't it make some sense to at least have an advisory along the lines Mr. Swanson is proposing?
And, Your Honor, this court actually discussed that spectrum in the Vonderchuk case about a year or so ago in a published decision in which it held that field sobriety tests are not searches within the scope of the Fourth Amendment. I know that doesn't quite get to the same analysis here. I think if the legislature wanted to impose an advisory requirement, law enforcement and everyone will follow, but the statute just doesn't require it. There's nothing to suggest that there's a constitutional requirement. And absent that requirement, I think it's a decision best left up to the legislative branch. This court and the Supreme Court has heard, you know, numerous procedural due process challenges to the entire scope of DWI processes, you know, culminating recently with the Morehouse case to the advisory itself. But through every step of the way, there's ample opportunity for the legislature to weigh in and say, we want to, you know, create extra protections. I would say in 1995, this court decided the Ruffin-Knock case, I think I'm reading it right. It's not cited in the briefs, but the citation is 528 Northwest 2nd 254, decision by this court in 1995. And it's sort of a case by analogy in which a driver argued that their procedural due process rights were violated because the officer wasn't required to advise the driver of the right to additional testing at the end of a testing process. I think, and this court rejected that, saying, yes, that could provide you with potentially exculpatory evidence, but it's just not required by Constitution and by law. Again, I think this is a pretty similar thing where those additional steps could be made, but I don't think it needs to be made through the scope of this case law, but more in the legislative process to just have the legislature continue to weigh in on how they want the scope of a DWI to proceed. I hope that sort of answers your question. I know I steered it a couple of different directions there. Are there any other questions?
I don't think so. Thank you, Mr.
Then
Young.
Then Commissioner would request that the order be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Swanson, you'll have the last word, sir.
Okay. I don't have too much on a rebuttal, but I always like to get any chance I can to basically talk about my position. I think a couple of things that I had briefly addressed in my brief was that there is some inconsistencies, I believe, in some police reports that were prepared by the officer concerning what his observations were and as compared to his testimony at the hearing. And I believe there's a case law, I think it's Reis, R-E-I-S, that basically goes in to state that the court, reviewing court, can look at any inconsistencies in an officer's testimony at a hearing as compared to reports he prepared that address the same issue. I mention this fact because on one of the peace officer's certificate, I think he put down his speech wasn't slurred, and then he testified at trial that slightly was slurred. And I think that's a big difference because, as the court mentioned during the initial questions to me, slightly slurred speech. Well, if a report says there was no slurred speech and then he testifies at the hearing there was slightly slurred speech, certainly slightly slurred speech is leaning towards going below the constitutional line about saying that there's a basis to have somebody exit the vehicle. I just think that sometimes that comes out at a hearing, and I think it's relevant because the credibility of an officer, like anything else in any type of a hearing, more often than not is up to scrutiny based upon reports that were prepared soon after the observation. And if those reports are consistent with his testimony, and if they're not, I think there is a basis to put his testimony at the hearing in doubt. And with that, I still am firm believing the aspect that this novel constitutional concept is ripe for discussions. I note for a fact that, as we all were aware, when the Minnesota Supreme Court made the decision in the Freedman case, which basically gave the right to call and consult with an attorney, now in just a breath test situation, the legislature hadn't passed any law to that effect. So counsel's suggestion that she's up to the legislature, no. I think it's at times it's up to the Supreme Court to advise the legislature. We think this should be the law of the land. And the legislature could, I mean, then what if the Supreme Court or the court says, there's some merits to this. I mean, there's actually some merits to why a person should not be advised, because all this stuff is going to be used against them, not only for the observable conduct, whether their speech or if they didn't understand something or if they had to basically repeat it once or twice. I mean, a lot of the evidence or testimony that is detrimental to a defendant, plaintiff, comes from not only the performance on these so-called field sobriety tests, but other aspects of the person under scrutiny. And I think that kind of sometimes tips the scale by, again, are we, no one wants to have any, anybody get hurt in the highways by alcohol, and that's a given. But I think the sake of public policy certainly has a base of reason in everyone's heart and everybody's mind. But there also is, I think in DWI case law, seems to be the most litigated case law there is, either on published or unpublished decisions, because maybe it's the creativity of defense lawyers, maybe it's not. But I think that it's probably the most charged out crime that we have in this state, in this country. I think my last static was there's over 40,000 DWIs a year in Minnesota. With that in mind, I just think there's the pendulum should all sometimes switch to what's reasonable. If a person is advised, they have a right to refuse. They don't have to. I mean, they can still take the test. And a lot of times being the good concept of the, I always like to say as Kirby Puckett when he went through downtown Minneapolis, the good Minnesota guy, I'll do them. Thank you, but I'll do them. But that seems to be the flavor sometimes of people in Minnesota. Okay, I'm a nice guy. That's fine. I'll do it. Thank you. And then go forward. And with that, I'll end.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Thank you, Mr. Young. The matter is submitted. That being our last case for oral argument, this morning we are adjourned.